Forever Dog.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of S&W Q&A, and it's Sharpling and Worcester Q&A, and it's I'm Tom, and of course we have John here.
Hello everybody.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Terrible weather last couple of days. I haven't seen the sun in forever. So
it's rough. That's here rough. Also, it is not doing, it rains every other day here.
Ugh.
It's bizarre.
Well, it's got to fill up the basin that all those cool car chase scenes are shot.
Yeah, grease when you race.
What's that called?
The reservoirs, like the,
yes,
where you bring your pink slip for your car and you're betting your car on the race. And I guess you hand over ownership of the car after you lose the race and then walk home.
Now, here's what I have always wondered about that concept.
Uh-huh.
Do both winner and loser at some point have to go to a notary?
To go to a notary to get approval to just transfer ownership of the car.
Yes.
The next day after the race.
They hate each other.
They're at a bank.
This is the greatest idea for a call ever.
Yeah. They're at a bank waiting to get the pink slip notarized for transfer. They're in the office of Prudential waiting for the insurance agent to transfer over the insurance.
So you sold it to him? Oh, no.
No, he beat me in a race.
Where? Where'd you race?
On the reservoir. Where everybody races. And then there's also just a second car there alone, just left there because the guy who won the race has a car to go home in.
Right.
And then there's just a car sitting in the reservoir waiting for him to bring a buddy back with the proper insurance to drive so it could be back on the road again.
Giving instructions to his friend Sal.
Yeah.
it should be in that drawer. The third drawer.
No, check that, there's a file. There's a row of files in the one drawer. Check for one that says car.
Okay, I see one that it says truck. Is it?
No,
is
it says car. I lost my truck 6 months ago in a truck race.
I seriously don't see it.
Yeah. Oh, man. I guess I'm going to have to go to the title holder and get them to reissue one. That'll be $40.
Oh, my God. I've only got 31.
Yeah.
And like, I lost me for however long.
And I lost the race also.
I have no money. My gal, she left. I mean, imagine that. Your gal would probably leave also, right?
Oh, there's no way if you're like hoofing at home after the race.
Yeah.
Walking. How far away from home? 9 miles.
Do you want to get a bus? I don't have any money.
I don't have that. I literally have no money.
Nothing.
Nothing. It's all I had was that car. I literally have nothing in this life now.
I'm failing. I'm a senior for the fourth time, and I don't even go. So I don't have any. I have nothing. Mm-hmm. I have no resume. I have nothing to look forward to except for that car.
That car was all I had.
It's all I had. Only joy I had.
Why'd I bet it? What was I even going to do with that other guy's car?
I know. I couldn't afford. I can't afford insurance for my car.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I was behind on insurance for my car.
This is like the Penthouse Forum follow-ups. It's like the true story of what actually would happen in cinema's greatest scenes.
Yeah. No, that you did that in a call we did last night. That was so funny, the idea of Penthouse Letters follow-ups and just the people realizing they made a huge mistake and they have to like try to hopefully they don't get caught in the aftermath of their mistake.
It was at that point that I looked at my phone. It was a message from Sheila. It was only one sentence. Who's Deirdre?
Yeah.
I knew then that my life was over.
Then I felt it was over. The end. This is actually how we have done calls over for a lot of our lives. That is,
yeah,
you know, a lot of time you come up with stuff and keep me so in the dark with things. And I'll get this cryptic email sent to me that says, when I say this, you say this. And then it's like, I have no idea who the character is,
right,
where it's going. And that's just like a comfort level I think we've gotten to where we can, it's just like we can just ride that ride together, and I can follow your lead. But you'll say, when I say things got really messy, then you just say, how'd they get messy? And then that'll kick off the rest of the call. And I'll just be like, I don't know. As the calls happen, a lot of these calls happen, I am right there with the audience, not sure where the road we're on. So
right, right.
And it's so much fun.
A lot of the joy for me is knowing that that's the case and then putting in something that only you will get.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it falls completely flat to anybody else.
Yeah, there's a couple. what it comes down to is everybody can get some of the references. Nobody gets all the references.
It's true.
Like, literally, I get them and you get them. But it's just like, beyond that, there's no way anybody else could maintain 100% batting average with that.
No.
Well, let's see what kind of questions we got here. Nathan asks, I know SCTV was a big influence on the both of you. Did Kids in the Hall have a similar impact? How do you gauge sketch comedy in the 90s?
I have zero connection to Kids in the Hall.
Okay.
None. I never watched it. I know it's great.
Mm-hmm.
I've met a couple of those guys. They're awesome. It just never, I don't know, for some reason it never called to me, and I need to see it. I honestly know almost nothing about
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah, I watched it when it was on Comedy. I watched it, I guess, wherever it was first, and then maybe, I forget where it was first. Was it on HBO first? Something like that? I'm not sure.
That sounds right, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But I liked it a lot. I didn't go as deep as other people do. Like, for some people, Kids in the Hall is like the touchstone.
Oh,
for
yeah.
them.
Absolutely.
And for me, and I guess I would assume for you, it's like that was SCTV for us. The one that that's yeah. like, that's the one that you want to know everything about, and you start to memorize characters and all these things. You know, it's a character I was talking to Peyton about, and he forgot about the existence of this character. Let me see if you remember. Do you remember Steve Roman?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. Yes. She made me...
Spell.
She used big words. She was really smart. She made me spell at a party.
At parties, and it was he was Steve Roman was John Candy, the 30th anniversary of his death just happened.
I think so.
Wow. He played this like former athlete who went into acting, Steve Roman, and he was the world's worst actor, who was like, he was convinced that like accents were the key to acting. Like, if like, I'm Steve Roman, and he was like, he would always like talk at the beginning of a special, it's like, Right. I'm Steve Roman. And in my new movie, I play a Mexican judge who feels like, and then he starts doing the accent and it's like kind of Swedish. Like he's,
hey, you want a cab?
Yeah. Bring in, he goes, bring in the next witness. Bring, he, like, and he would just be like, and this one's on film. Like, I remember that was right. Like a lot. He was so proud that it was on film.
Yeah.
And Brock Linehan interviewed Steve Roman, the great Martin Short character.
I didn't know until I was prepping for my interview with Mike Delaney about SCTV that that's based on a real person whose name was very similar. Do you know what it was?
I do. I'm blanking on what his name was, but
it might
yes.
be Linehan.
It I think it was Linehan. Something Linehan, like Brett Linehan or something. I'm blank. Like but yes, that was based on a real person that I honestly don't know much about. Yeah, SCTV was the beginning and end for me with that stuff.
But we both loved Mr. Show.
Oh, that's I guess that second half of the question is
yeah.
about sketch comedy in the 90s. Mr. Show was the next thing that really mattered.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I still watch that stuff often. It's so great. It's just great.
And I remember, you tell me if you had a similar experience. When I first started watching Mr. Show, David Cross immediately popped. You're just like, this guy. And you're almost like, this guy's the funnier of the two.
Right.
Just because his thing translated immediately. And you're like, well, the other guy's not as funny as David, but I'm sure he's pretty good. And then you start watching it more and you're just like, oh, he's totally his equal.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Odenkirk just suddenly jumped out. You're just like, oh, now I get who this guy. And it was just because he looked like just a normal guy.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of like, oh, now I see who he is. And then he becomes my favorite for.
Oh, yeah.
Like
Senator Tankerbell.
Senator Tankerbell. Yeah. I'm trying to think the moment he jumped out for me, maybe when he was in the donut shop trying to, like with the cold, he was doing that character who had a cold.
Yeah.
And he's just taking forever to order, to pick
and
his donuts
I
out.
I would like one glazed donut, please, for me to have. Just the sentence never ended.
And Bob Odenkirk also had a line that is one of your all-time favorite lines, which is, I'm going to get it wrong. My wife's on my ass.
Greatest line of all time.
Yeah.
Oh, damn it. Oh, no, it's okay. No, it's not your cancer. My wife has been on my ass to bring home this magazine all week.
Yeah. just the funniest line. Which reminds me a lot of the Bob Dylan line from those AJ, the Garbology guy.
Right.
Talking to where that guy was recording. Hey, Bob, you're on a guard or thing? And he's like, I'll bring the article by a studio. And he's like, I'm not going to be at the studio, man. I'm not going to be there till the weekend. It's like, well, bring it by today. No, you can't. I got to build this shelf, man. My wife.
I don't remember that.
If I don't build this shelf, my wife's going to kill me.
Oh, my God.
Like,
see? It's not just Deirdre.
No. It was Sarah Dillon.
It was Sarah Dillon.
Yeah. Nah, my wife's all over. My wife, if I don't build this shelf, my wife's going to kill me. I'm going to write a song about you. I'm going to call it Pig.
Pig.
And then the guy goes, okay, yeah, that'd be cool. And then he goes, I'm not writing the song about, like, when he realized the guy liked that, he'd be immortalized with a song. Let's see what we have here. How do you imagine a Freaky Friday? Lucas asks, how do you imagine a Freaky Friday best show would go where John is in the studio and Tom is calling in? I would say it would be the same as it is, more or less. It just,
I think so.
I think we would just fall into the other person's chair pretty easily. Yeah. Because when we talk about these things, we've done years of it, and there'll be times when you're asking me questions as we like.
Oh, my memory is that's how like 80% of them started, where the roles were reversed
and we're
in the conjuring of it.
Yes. And we're just trying on each other, or we'd both ask each other questions. We'd both become the Tom in the dynamic, asking, and I'd ask you a question. Then you would ask me a question as the character. We'd figure it out. Yeah. I don't think it would be very, I don't think there would be much of a difference.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, I think it'd be real similar, and it would show, you know, just how interwoven we are.
Yes, exactly. They were both just like sharing one comedy brain.
Yeah.
Speaking of Tom asks, John, the Murmur Tour was so great. What was the experience like for you, especially the show in Athens? And what was the hardest Murmur song to play? And this, for people who don't know, this John just did this incredible tour that was Michael Shannon, the actor, Jason Narducci, who you play with in Bob Mould's band,
mm-hmm.
and you were the drummer. And just so, who else was in the band?
We had a cat named, his name is spelled D-A-G, but it's pronounced dog. He played guitar.
Okay.
Rickenbacker. Nick Mincy was on bass.
Okay.
A guy named Vivek was the keyboard player. And he was amazing because he would, he programmed, somehow he was able to extract a lot of the sounds on the record that were just kind of like manufactured by Mitch Easter or Don Dixon, like the sound of pool balls hitting together, but slowed down dramatically. Mm-hmm. So he was able to kind of get all those samples in the keyboard. So
mm-hmm.
everything was very true to the record because of him.
Yeah. Everything I've seen, it looked just like the greatest experience.
It was amazing. Yeah. We started in San Francisco. We played a couple shows there, and then we went to Minneapolis and then down to Athens, and we played our way up. And the show in Athens was just amazing.
It seems like that's like a legendary moment to get to be a part of that. Cause what happened was
they were all there. They all four of the guys came, Mike, Michael, Peter, and Bill. And, They watched the entire show. Peter got up and played a couple songs, and I've played with Peter before
mm-hmm.
a bunch, but
in Minus Five, right?
Yeah, Minus Five, and this Nuggets thing we just did mm-hmm. With Lenny Kaye and a few other things. But I don't think ever an REM song. So we did that song South Central Rain, and he played with us. And the end of the song, it kind of ramps up in terms of like the intensity and stuff.
Sure.
And it was the first time I ever played with him where he did the thing, you know, like the shoulder thing, but
wow,
like
okay.
super rocking. That is just that it is Peter Buck. So that was super exciting
to be that you got to see the guy who you would see on stage. You're now getting that version of him
doing the thing.
That's
wild. So that was great. Mike Mills sang a bunch of those great backup vocals on a lot of the songs from Reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael didn't sing, but he came out and he talked for a bit and thanked the band and, you know, basically said how much it meant to them, which mm-hmm. was so nice. And he and Michael Shannon got really close that day. They hung out a lot, and Michael Stipe took him to all the sites, like the trestle that's on the cover mm-hmm. and where they went to, you know, where they'd go hang out and the group houses they lived in. So he had an amazing time also. And, but I got to Athens a couple days before and hung out with our friend DeWitt, who you've known over the years. DeWitt Burton is REM's equipment guy, manages their rehearsal space. And so he hooked me up with Bill Berry, you know, who's kind of a, not a secretive guy, but he's, you know, you don't see him out a lot. You don't
he's a little bit outside the circle of just being out and about.
Yeah. And he's one of my biggest inspirations in terms of, coming up with parts, because he's a songwriter. He's really, you know, he writes his drum part for the song to showcase the song. And I've really taken a lot of his, you know, things he's done over the years and incorporated them in a lot of Superchunk songs, a lot of Mountain Goat songs, all kinds of things. And so anyway, DeWitt put us together and we hung out a few times before the show, went to lunch and stuff. And he gave me a drum of his. And
oh my God, that's so
just
cool.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Bill came out and played the song Perfect Circle on the piano. He didn't want to play drums.
Okay.
And so it was really fun getting a lot of the inside scoop of how they made things, you know, how they made the records and how they recorded it. And the next night we played in Chapel Hill, where I live, and Mitch Easter, who co-produced the first two albums and the EP, he joined us for the second half of Murmur on guitar.
Oh, that's amazing.
And we just grilled him for like at least an hour after the show, just everybody in the band, just like with all questions about how they did it, why they do this. And he was amazing. So it was like, you know, it would be like for you getting to, you know, just hang out with, whoever, Martin Short and Richard Kind for an entire day and asking them everything about.
Absolutely. I mean, look, we have one thing in common is that REM was kind of like it was almost like the starting pistol for just that next part of my, whatever, you know. I was a kid when I started listening to them, and they were very instructional in terms of how you could conduct yourself as an artist, in terms of like, you can do the things you want to do, you can have integrity, but you can carve out your success with it. One of the most meaningful bands when I look back.
Oh God.
I was just every bucket full of brains and the bob, and just I would buy if anything said REM on it, I just bought it. Unseen, just like. And I learned the Velvet Underground. REM is where I heard them first. Their covers of those. Of what, like Femme Fatale and Pale Blue Eyes, I think they did, right?
There She Goes.
Yeah, just those covers, whether they were on a bootleg or whether they were on a B-side, they were, and also just the way they made it a priority to always hype bands they liked.
Right.
Like they were always.
While I'm thinking about it, we would play There She Goes during the show we did. And before the show at the 40 Watt in Athens, we were talking about the song, me and a couple guys in the band. And Peter just goes, you know, Lou liked me. He was nice to me. So,
wow.
Which I thought it was funny because you hear so many, you know, stories of the opposite. But I just thought it was exciting. He was so excited to say that.
That
Lou did like it.
That's so funny.
I mean, that's a badge.
Oh yeah. And so you start to hear now about Lou Reed that like the people closest to him just were just like, it's just a defense mechanism to keep people who aren't in the inner circle away. And it was almost like a joke to them that he would play the character of Lou Reed when dealing with these other people and then just be a different guy when they were alone.
Oh, did I tell you the story of, I had a super early flight after the second show in San Francisco we did, the REM thing. I was flying to Minneapolis. And so I'm down at the lobby to get my lift at like 4 a.m. So it's just me and the guy behind the desk who's looking, who's probably in his late 60s.
Okay.
we start talking about all the bands he saw in San Francisco back then. And he said, I saw the Velvet Underground. I go, no way. Mm-hmm. And he goes, yeah, I'd heard the record or something, and it sounded like it was something I'd like. And I went, but before I went earlier that day, I hailed a cab, and I was about to get into the cab, but I could tell somebody else was getting in on the other side.
Uh-huh.
And it was Lou Reed.
Oh my God.
And the way he told the story, he said it was Lou Reed and his guitarist. I assume it was probably Cale.
Or Sterling Morrison, or
the way he said okay. He described it like he might have been Welsh or so.
Sure. Okay.
You know, an accent. Mm-hmm. And so, but the way he told the story, Lou was the nice guy.
Yeah, John.
Of the two.
John Cale is an equivalently difficult guy.
That's what I'm hearing a lot now.
Yeah. It's funny. I was backstage with Kurt. There was a thing, it was the 75th. John Cale's 75th birthday celebration, which it would have been, I guess, 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was living in New Jersey. So it was at BAM in Brooklyn. Two nights. First night, John Cale and friends playing the first Velvet Underground album.
Wow.
And second night, John Cale playing solo stuff.
Ooh.
Mm. Yeah. First night, John Dwyer from OCs is in the band. MGMT, those guys were a part of it. And Kurt was there. Kurt Vile was in the band. And like John liked Kurt. Like he kind of liked him. So he asked him to play. Hey, you want to just jump in on the second night too? And so he did.
Yeah.
Kurt's like, I can get you backstage for this. We go back to this. It's really tight, but we get through, me and him, in this backstage dressing room. So like oversized, like reception area dressing room. And everybody's just talking, kind of crowded in. And I see like a water cooler. I'm just going to get some water. And I go over, and sitting next to it is John Cale, who just like looks at me. And I immediately I was terrified. It's just like he was burning. I didn't say anything to him. I didn't do anything.
Why are you here?
Yeah, it was like that. It was like, why are you here? And there's nothing more uncomfortable than if you listen to John Cale on WTF. Mark, the label didn't send Mark the new John Cale album.
Oh, no.
So Mark's talking about producing the Stooges, the Velvets, you know, Patti Smith, all these things. And then John Cale at point goes, well, you know, we've talked a lot about the past, and it would be, I really would like to talk about some of the present stuff, like the new record. And then Mark's like, the new record? God. He's like,
I'm nervous.
He's like, they sent you the new record, of course. And he's like, no. Oh my God, the disappointment. It makes me, that's one of the scariest moments, like hearing this guy get sad and mad at like, but not verbalize it. You can just tell he's right. So mad right now. And someone's going to get yelled at so badly. You don't send him the record? I go and talk for an hour and he can't even talk about the new music.
Oh,
The thing with, that's very funny. What was the most difficult song to play?
Yeah. This was the hardest song I've ever had to play in my life. And I don't know if I ever got it completely right. 9-9 or 9-9.
Sure.
It's such an incredibly bizarre song. None of us could really count it the same way as everybody mm-hmm. else. So it was always hanging over me specifically, like all day. Like I've never listened to a song more than this song. I mean, it was just incredible. Uh-huh. But the funny thing is, none of the four guys, Mike, Peter, Bill, Michael, could really give us much instruction because it was just, it's just this crazy song that it, the drums are completely upside down. It's so bizarre. And I don't love songs where I have to count. And this was a song where I had to count to five a lot.
Okay.
Which is so, which is crippling, but, but it got to be a funny thing.
I want people to also know it's not, it's not crippling because you don't know how to count to five. It's because you, it's your drumming while counting.
Yeah. Yes. And then when the drums come in, they're the reverse of what they should be. So instead of like normally in a rock song, the snare drum is on 2 and 4. So it's like 2, 4, 2, 4. Mm. This was snare drum on 1 and 3. So, but like not reggae. So just everything upside down, everyone counting it weird. But every morning after a show, I would text Bill Berry and just say, nailed it at soundcheck, 70% correct during the show. and then like after the third time, he writes back, you know, you could always drop it. We did really early on.
Yeah, that one fell out of the rotation pretty early. Yeah. That's so funny. Yeah. It also is amazing, like, you going on this thing. I started listening to those first two records, which meant everything. Like, I it's so crazy how fully formed they were. Like,
yeah,
like Murmur is like, sounds like this. It sounds like some other band's fifth album.
Well, while we're on that, my understanding is that to a lot of their friends who had seen them forever, it sounded like another band. Because you listen to those, whatever, the shows from that tour or a little before, they're still a garage band, kind of.
Yeah.
And so it's a real testament to Mitch and Don, like, how that record turned out. I think those guys wanted it to turn out like that, but I don't think they quite knew how to get it, you know?
Sure.
It's such a, it's so atmospheric. It's
the,
so...
The arrangements
oh, it's so amazing.
Insane.
Yeah.
The, like...
Yeah.
Like... Mike Mills's counter harmonies are they're so complex. It's really that must have been such a shocker for people to see them and then hear that record and just be like, "Wow, oh my, who's this?"
Oh yeah. Yeah, just amazing.
Let's see. Michael asks, this question is more for Tom, but John can probably answer his equivalent to it. What is your worst lawn experience at the PNC Bank Arts Center in Holmdel, New Jersey? Everyone from the area usually has at least one.
You and I spent a night there once, didn't we?
We did. You were opening.
We'll talk about that later.
You were playing with Whiskey Town, right?
That's, yep.
Opening for John Fogerty.
Yes.
And yeah, I saw you play there. That was... So for me, first of all, that's the place I talked about it in the book I wrote, going as a child to see a production of Cinderella. Was who what's Tinkerbell from? Why am I drawing such a blank?
Is that Peter Pan?
Yes, Peter Pan, of course. I don't know. And there was like a badminton shuttlecock came down on a string as Tinkerbell and then didn't come back when it's like you're supposed to, everyone's supposed to clap and pray for Tinkerbell to come back to life or whatever. Right. And it didn't happen for whatever, like, technical, I don't know what it was. I just remember being like, wait, aren't we supposed to cheer for Tinkerbell to come back to life? Like, we left, like, with the other one, and this is like the mark of being like a dopey kid. I'm in it probably right out of high school. I'm so into the Beach Boys at this point. And I'm like going to record shows, tracking down. Oh, I found a copy of Sunflower. Like, cause none of these things were in print. Their stock was at an all time low in the '80s. Like, nobody wanted, there was no Brian Wilson is a genius thing being truly embraced by people. Like, people who knew, and but most people, that was not the accepted narrative for just music fans. They were the band that played those surf songs. So I'm going to this show, but I'm so deep into it now. And I deluded myself into just like, man, I wonder what songs they're going to play. I wonder if they'll play like, you think they'll play anything off of like Carl and the Passions, So Tough? Like, I wonder if they'll play like Marcella. Who knows? I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know how I had like straight up fooled myself into thinking they were going to do anything other than let's go surfing now, everybody's. And they just did the hits. And I was so mad. I just remember being like, oh, come on, guys. You got so much more than this. It's like, of course they're not playing any of that stuff.
No.
Do you have any shed stories like that?
My memory of that night, this was the summer of 98. And as Tom said, Whiskey Town was opening for John Fogerty on a tour. And Tom and I were in the heat of writing this show or a pitch for this show that we ended up taking to MTV that almost got piloted.
Yeah.
And I remember
it was supposed to shoot. It got canceled the day it was supposed to film.
Yes.
Just so people realize how close we got to filming this show that we came up with.
And my memory of us turning lemons into lemonade that day, I think, unless I'm confusing timelines, I remember going to Ray's Pizza on St. Mark's, and we wrote most of Rock and Roll Dreams Will Come Through that day.
We absolutely did at that's after the thing got canceled.
Right, right.
And we went and kind of like we're walking around the village or whatever, and we went to go to this pizza place that was on St. Mark's and whatever, and we sat at a booth and just started writing this song on like a piece of paper, and we were just making each other laugh with it, and we wrote this full thing more or less at that pizzeria.
Yep.
That was so funny because there was a Meatloaf song called Rock and Roll Dreams Will Come True.
I think it was Rock and Roll Dreams come.
Yeah.
Is it true? It must be true. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause our song is Rock and Roll Dreams Will Come Through. Right. I think his was Rock and Roll Dreams Come True. And we thought that was the funniest name for a song. Just thinking about that. Rock and Roll Dreams Come True. What does that even mean? So we started like, we were so amused with the idea of Dreamsel, like dreams apostrophe LL, and thinking that was the funniest thing. We wrote that sitting.
We were in the midst of working on that idea, and you came to the whatever that venue was called. Was it called the Garden?
The Garden. It was the Garden State Arts Center at that point.
So you came to the show, and we had plans to work after Whiskey Town played. And I remember coming off stage after we played, and I think you were kind of back there, but immediately to my left was Bruce and Max.
Unbelievable.
Yes. Yeah. We didn't meet or anything, but that was,
it was exciting. John.
Hey, do you guys need any lawn work?
one of the longer running concepts on the show is Bruce Springsteen being terrified of not having money. So he took part-time gigs when he wasn't in the East, when he wasn't on tour, or even when he was on tour, he'd still work.
Pat just because
he was just worried about not having money.
Yeah.
Let's see where we're at. I'm going to ask you a question now as we end this episode. Do you have, speaking of this type of touring, what is a story you have touring in one of the bands that was like a for hire drumming thing, not a band that you were a member of, because you've obviously been a member of Superchunk and Bob's mm-hmm. band, Mountain Goats, but there's been other things where you've jumped on a thing to mm-hmm. help out and, or, you know, be the drummer for a specific tour or whatever. Like, what is that like to be in that position? And do you have any funny things come to mind?
I kind of like it now, like now when I'll get hired to do something like that, because, you know, because I have a home, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a mothership. I consider the Mountain Goats and Bob Mould and the Best Show kind of mothership. So, mm-hmm. so it's a lot less pressure now if I get asked to do a tour with someone or play on a record, because I've got jobs. Whereas yeah. in the past it was like, I better just play 100% correct on this, or, you know, my career as a drummer is,
yeah, you're
is
on the over. Line. So, you're...
Yeah. So it's a lot more fun now. I'm trying to think the first thing that came to mind, it's very little, but it's so not me. I played with this woman, and you would come see us when we'd play the Mercury Lounge or something. When I did that Whiskey Town tour opening for Fogarty, I ended up meeting the fiddle player, Caitlin Carey, who yes. played in Whiskey Town. And then she asked me to play on a record and do a tour with her. So this is like the next year, or maybe 2000. And we played this place in Rhode Island in Providence. And the monitor guy was just the worst. He was so, like, he was inept and lazy. And I just remember, this is so not me. After the show, we're tearing down, and he says, "Hey, everything go all right?" And I looked right at him, and I still can't believe I said this. I said, "You know, I've played a lot of shows in my life, and that was the worst performance by a monitor mixer I've ever encountered." And he completely took it like he earned it. And he goes, "I'm sorry." Like he knew he sucked. It was so weird.
Yeah.
And then we ended up going the short distance to our hotel. And as we got out of the van, these three, like, remember when Jimmy Fallon and Ben Affleck would do the Boston guys on SNL?
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
three guys just like that. And there were two women in our band, and the two women get out of the van, and one of the guys just goes, "I like older women." And they weren't that much older than these guys. And so
weird.
So it was so weird. We go inside, press, you know, the elevator button. It opens up. Pile of vomit.
it's like you're in like Twin Peaks now.
That's all the end. Sudden. Yeah, that's the end of this night. So.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So, but like, I feel like back in those days, kind of every day had something stupid like mm-hmm. that, and that's why I still love doing it, because it feeds into what we do. So I mean, yeah. like I, you know, I keep a running tally of stupid shit I see every day. Mm-hmm. And tell you about it, yep. and then you tweak yeah. it, and then it's a call.
it's so funny. One final thing is, you mentioned being in the lobby in San Francisco talking to the guy with Velvet Underground. Is that where you were near the elevator?
It was just 5 feet.
5 feet from
the legendary.
I get a picture sent to me a month and a half ago. Just... I get a text, and it's just a picture of an elevator, and it's the elevator that I walked into with Patti Smith. And again, I remember there was the moment when that happened, and you watched me come out of it, and then I was just like, this is what happened. And you were just like, it was like understood that this dies right here, right? Like, right. And then I was like, I think I gotta... Like, I think I got to tell this one.
Yeah.
That was, yeah. And then Claire O'Kane was a witness to it also, strangely enough.
That's right.
That Claire was performing at the Sketchfest. So Claire also got a chance to witness the look of horror on my face when I stepped out of that elevator. Yeah, I asked her if she had ever seen Humble Pie back in the day. Oh, no.
Can I ask you a question?
Oh yeah, let's do it on the next one.
Next one? Okay.
Yeah.
It feeds directly from this. So.
Okay, well, we'll pick it back up.
All right.
So this is a thing. Listen to the next episode of S&W Q&A if you want to hear the continuation of this story. And thanks everybody who is on Patreon for the show. We appreciate it, and we'll be back with a new episode very soon. Bye.
Goodbye.